to Psy.
Spend the day with Psy.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Sidearm, continuing the special series of musings by Professor Venkatraman entitled The Essence of the Gita, Radio Psy presents today the fourth talk. This musing series on the Gita comes to you in response to requests made by our listeners over the years and is being broadcast in alternation with our other series on spiritual awareness. The two series are complementary to each other, and that is why we have intertwined them. We hope you enjoy both and find them to be beneficial. Over now to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sai Ram and greetings once again from Prashanthi Nilayam. This is my fourth talk in the series on the essence of the Gita. Thus far, we have navigated through the second chapter of the Gita entitled Sankhya Yoga. I hope you have not entirely forgotten all that I have said before. While dealing with the Sankhya Yoga, I pointed out the following. 1. Krishna told Arjuna that his difficulty was arising from a lack of sufficient discrimination, spiritual discrimination that is. 2. Krishna pointed out that the question was not about killing one's relatives, but about whether to do one's duty or to abandon it. 3. Krishna continued, everyone has duties to perform, and no one is exempt from duties, from kings to paupers to even saints. 4. Krishna then turns to the question, what exactly is duty? Duty involves actions, and to perform the right action, one must first be clear as to whether the proposed action is based on consideration of the temporary or the permanent. 5. Krishna told Arjuna that he was trying to decide his course of action on the basis of body consciousness. That meant that Arjuna was giving importance to the temporary. Arjuna was saying he would not fight because his grandfather, gurus and so on were in the opposing army. Thereupon, Krishna explains that bodies are temporary, born to perish. The issue was not one of Bhishma versus Arjuna, but Adharma versus Dharma. As a soldier and warrior, Arjuna had a duty to protect Dharma. Bhishma, etc. were on the side of Adharma. That being the case, how could Arjuna chicken out, especially at the very last moment? 6. All human beings are the embodiments of the Atma, the body being a mere outer dress of sorts. While the body is temporary, the Atma within is eternal. Thus, the nature of actions that one performs must be guided by considerations of the permanent or the Atma rather than of the transient or the body that covers the Atma. In a sense, that is the touchstone one must use to make the correct decision when caught in a moral dilemma. For example, the situation may arise when one might feel that there was an urgent necessity to pay a bribe so as to get something done. On the other hand, paying a bribe amounts to supporting adharma. One might argue that if the bribe were paid, some good would result. That might be so, but the Gita makes it very clear that it is not enough for the ends alone to be good. The means also must be good, as the last shloka proclaims. That is what Mama Dharma is all about, choosing that course of action that is based on considerations of the permanent rather than the temporary. If that is done, there would be no conflict between the means and the ends. Later, I hope to offer many illustrations so that the concept becomes clearer. Okay, so the first point we have to appreciate is that Arjuna's problem was not one of to fight or not to fight, but one of performing an action guided by considerations of the permanent, namely the Atma, rather than the temporary, namely the body. The eternal is God, and actions performed keeping the eternal in mind would always be pleasing to God. Hence, we must always choose that course of action that Swami would approve of, that is to say, actions that are God-oriented. The question now becomes, how to find out if Swami would approve of what we are planning to do? Should one go to Puttaparthi to find out? What if Swami does not grant an interview and thus an opportunity to check out? Krishna gave the answer over 5,000 years ago. His formula is really simple. One, use your power of discrimination, spiritual discrimination that is, to check out if your proposed action is desirable or not, in the sense I've explained. Two, but remember, the faculty of discrimination or buddhi would not work if you are in the grip of your internal enemies. That means internal purity is a must if discrimination or buddhi is to work properly. This internal purity is what Swami often refers to as Trikarna Shuddhi, or the harmony of thought, word and deed in the pursuit of goodness. More about this internal purity later. For the present, let us note that Krishna has stressed the importance of sense and mind control in order to keep buddhi in shape. Without the control of the senses and the mind, buddhi would be blunted. If buddhi becomes blunt, spiritual discrimination would automatically fail. And when that happens, one can easily delude oneself and make all kinds of wrong judgments, sometimes leading to great disaster. In fact, history is full of examples where this has been proved true. Okay, so much for chapter 2, and we are now ready to consider chapters 3 and 4, dealing mainly with the Karma Yoga and some of its aspects. Actually, Krishna gives a brief hint about Karma Yoga in chapter 2 itself, but the elaboration comes in the chapters just mentioned. Now, why is Karma Yoga so important? Because it is the practical aspect of Mama Dharma. The headlines as far as chapter 3 is concerned are the following. 1. None can remain perfectly inactive. Action is inevitable as long as we live. 2. However, the action must be meaningful in the sense it must be in the spirit of Karma Yoga. Otherwise, it is tantamount to inaction in a spiritual sense, that is. 3. Action must be performed with perfect detachment if possible, at least to the extent possible. 4. One must accept the position one has been placed in by destiny and do the very best one can while in that position in the spirit of a Karma Yogi. 5. Karma Yoga is not exactly easy. Desire is its main foe, which means that if one aspires to be a Karma Yogi, then one must burn all feelings of desire within. This may not be easy, but at least to the extent possible, desires must be kept in check. And now a quick look at the slokas related to the headlines above, after which I shall offer some brief comments on them. Here come the slokas. Freedom from action is the culmination of Karma Yoga, and that freedom does not come without first entering upon action. Nor can one reach perfection, the culmination of Sankhya Yoga, merely by refusing to act. This is Sloka 3.4. Indeed, none can ever remain inactive even for a moment, for everyone is relentlessly and helplessly driven to action by one's intrinsic nature or gunas. This is Sloka 3.5. He who claims to be inactive merely by being motionless but nonetheless broods on sense objects is a deluded fool and in fact a hypocrite. 3.6. On the other hand, superior is he who engages in action but with full control of the mind and the senses. This is Sloka 3.7. Therefore, do thy duty as prescribed. For duty-bound action is superior to inaction. Forget not that action is required even to maintain the body. This is Sloka 3.8. Actions normally fetter the human being, but not when they are performed as acts of sacrifice. Therefore, O Kaunteya, act and perform their duty without attachment and in a spirit of sacrifice. This is Sloka 3.9. Know that all action originates from the Supreme One who is imperishable and all-pervading. And in sacrificial action, this Supreme Spirit is consciously present. This is an important sloka and its number is 3.15. Partha, one who does not resolve with the wheel of sacrifice but seeks instead mundane pleasures through the gratification of the senses, lives in vain. This very important sloka carries the number 3.16 and it is very, very important for us in this Kali Age. One's own duty, though seemingly devoid of merit, is superior to that of another, even if well performed. It is preferable and honorable to doing one's duty. Undertaking another's duty is fraught with danger. This also is an important sloka and its number is 3.35. Desire is the wise man's eternal foe, O Kaunteya, and is like an insatiable fire. This very important warning is contained in sloka 3.39. Okay, so much for the key slokas, and now allow me to make some comments on these things. We hardly realize how important the spirit of Karma Yoga is for the good of society. I got a good lesson of that in March 1999 from a discourse that Swami delivered while visiting Delhi. Delhi, as everyone knows, is the capital city of India, synonymous with politics, government, government offices galore, etc., etc. In his discourse, Bhagwan said that seva or service did not mean that one ought to pick up a broom and start sweeping the villages. No doubt that kind of work did qualify to be called seva. However, said Swami, doing one's job properly in the true spirit of Karma Yoga also qualified to be described as seva. In fact, doing one's job properly constituted about 90% of Karma Yoga. 90%, mind you. Addressing pointedly the government officials who had come in thousands for Bhagavan's darshan, Swami said that avoiding work while drawing a huge salary was a sin. This is very similar in spirit to Sloka 3.16. On the other hand, working sincerely without any concern for the salary received was real seva. It was seva because all government work was in principle directed towards public welfare. Swami added that these days people draw a salary of 10,000 rupees and do not perform even 100 rupees worth of work. As one who has had a ringside view of the way the governmental system works, I know how true Swami's statement is. Let us reflect on all this for a moment. In the old days, government officials in India were known as public servants and with good reason. They were employed by the people for serving the people. If, however, the government officials come to the office, waste their time discussing office politics and spend rest of their time currying favor with the bosses or in making personal phone calls and so on, then is that not a crime against society? What is the point of such people reporting afterwards for sevadal duty, wearing a scarf and going through some weak motions of alleged seva? In this particular discourse, Swami was sending a very clear signal that doing one's work diligently while at one's workstation and serving society thereby was also seva. Seva was not just wearing a scarf and sweeping villages as many think it is. Karma Yoga stresses emphatically that doing one's duty in the situation destiny places one in life is far superior than seeking some other duty and trying to perform it. I shall give two examples, obvious though they are. Example 1. There is a young couple with a small child. The aged parents of the young man live with the couple. The young couple leave their kid with the elders asking them to do babysitting and rush off wearing scarves to do seva. Is this real service? Such things are common in high society also. In India, many wives of senior army officers leave their kids with nannies and push off to do social service. Swami has in the old days drawn pointed attention to such aberrations, saying that such actions spring from an ignorance about what seva really is. All this is the result of lack of proper discrimination. Example 2. There is a doctor who is very money-minded in his profession. Yet because he is a Sai devotee, he wears a scarf during weekends and attends medical camps. I wonder what exactly his attitude would be while rendering so-called service in those medical camps. In short, Karma Yoga and Mama Dharma are not really far off from daily life, and we need not imagine that they become relevant only in extreme crisis situations. As Krishna emphasizes, life is a sequence of actions in many of which the application of discrimination becomes very important. And to sharpen the knife of spiritual discrimination, the discipline of sense and mind control is absolutely vital. A person with good sense and mind control would always be calm. He would be able to analyze situations dispassionately and take the right decisions. It is because the concept of Karma Yoga is so intimately intertwined with human life that Gita has been described as an indispensable manual of life, and that also is why Gandhi constantly consulted the Gita in relation to almost everything that he did. Slokas 3.15 and 3.16 also clarify the place of man in the cosmos and the role he is expected to play. Scholars hardly ever draw attention to these slokas, but these slokas assume special importance in the context of some of the recent discourses of Swami, in which he has drawn attention to an important hierarchy that goes from the individual to society to nature and finally to God. This is a topic that would occupy a lot of our attention later. Sloka 3.15 also tells us that God is the very embodiment of sacrifice. By the way, the lives of the avatars offer any number of examples of supreme sacrifice, and one really does not have to look beyond Swami for proof. That is my point number one. Point number two is that if an individual sacrifices, that act of sacrifice would be in perfect harmony with the divine spark within. Point number three, which is also very important, is Krishna's specific call that every individual must sacrifice and not abandon that practice. I shall have more to say about this later, but here let me just say that every entity in nature receives as well as gives. Humans, being a part of nature, must also do the same, but unlike other living species that are hardwired to maintain the balance between receiving and giving, humans can dodge giving even while they are receiving. In other words, they can cheat deliberately. That, says Krishna, is unacceptable. This remark is very important since these days there is a lot of cheating going on. By the way, it's interesting to note that out of all the entities in the cosmos, it is humans alone who are not hardwired and therefore capable of going against dharma or their intrinsic nature. For example, a stone can only roll down the hill. It cannot go up the slope on its own. That is its dharma. Man, however, can create many choices and act according to his fancy, violating dharma in the process, and that is where all the trouble starts. Okay, so much for chapter 3, and now let us move on and take a brief look at chapter 4 by focusing on a few crucial slokas relevant to us. They are the following. He who sees action in inaction and inaction in action is enlightened among men. Verily, he is a yogi and one who has done all he need to. This is Sloka 4.18. The act of offering is Brahman, and the offering is also Brahman. The one who offers is Brahman, and the sacred fire into which the oblation is being offered is also Brahman. He alone attains Brahman, who in all his actions is fully absorbed in Brahman. This sloka is of course very familiar to most of us. It is sloka 4.24 in the Gita. Seek enlightenment by serving and prostrating before illumined souls, and learn through reverential questioning. I shall have more to say about this sloka shortly, and it carries the number 4.34. Okay, now for some comments. Let me start with sloka 434 that I just quoted. There is an interesting story behind it that goes as follows. One day, when Shirdi Baba was in the masjid, which is where Baba usually spent a lot of time, his devotee Nana Sahib Chandorkar was massaging Baba's legs and at the same time muttering something. A conversation then ensued between Baba and Nana Sahib, which went as follows. Baba: Nana, what are you mumbling to yourself? Nana: Baba, I am reciting a sloka in Sanskrit. Baba: What sloka? Nana: From the Bhagavad Gita. Baba: Nana, why do you mutter? Chant it fully so that I can also hear. Nana: Tatvidi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upatekshantim te jnanam jnani nath sattva darshinaha. Baba: Nana, do you understand it? Nana: Yes, of course, Baba, I do understand it. Baba: In that case, Nana, explain it to me. Nana then starts off as follows. Baba: It means by prostrating before the Guru, questioning the Guru, serving him, learn what jnana is. At this point, Baba says, Nana, stop. I don't want this collective translation. Explain that stanza to me word by word. And that is where Nana gets into trouble. He tries to give a word-for-word explanation of the sloka, but Baba chastises Nana at every stage, making Nana look silly. Nana then realized that Baba, appearing like an ignorant person, was really acting. It was a typical put-on, like all avatars do. As Swami sometimes says, man knows nothing but acts as though he knows everything. God, on the other hand, knows everything but often acts as though he knows nothing. That precisely is what happened on this occasion. Further, Baba explained an important truth, and that's what I want to get at. You see, gurus do not teach jnana as we often imagine. This might seem strange, and you might wonder, what on earth is it that gurus do? That Swami has explained. Swami says, jnana or spiritual wisdom is latent in every human being, since every person is an embodiment of the Atma. Thus, jnana comes with the individual right at birth. What happens is that the guru, through his teachings, removes ajnana or spiritual ignorance that tends to cover jnana. When ignorance or ajnana is scrubbed away by the guru, jnana, which until then was covered or eclipsed by ignorance, stands revealed. This is very important, and I hope you understand it. Let me next consider the sloka that deals with action and inaction. This remark of Krishna is particularly relevant in this Kali age, when everyone seems so very busy and is going around furiously appearing to do this and that. Krishna is telling us that in God's view, all this furious action is meaningless, and that action alone is worthwhile, that is spiritually significant. For example, a rich businessman might be very active, in fact hyperactive, wheeling and dealing, jetting across continents, being in Melbourne one day and in Moscow on the next day, buying up companies, swinging up contracts and what have you. All this may be good for the tycoon's business, but since it all springs from the businessman's ambition and desire to be rich and powerful, the actions have a low rating in the spiritual world. On the other hand, there might be a saint who is lost in meditation, who thus appears inactive. That is what the world would think of the saint. However, where God is concerned, such a man is highly active. You might ask, how is that possible when the man is so inactive physically? Well, I can do no better than set the example of Ramana Maharishi, whose name must be familiar to many of you listeners. As many listeners would recall, Ramana spent most of his life withdrawing into himself. People would go to his ashram wanting not only his darshan, but with many questions to ask. However, Ramana hardly gave any opportunities for devotees to ask questions. He sat mostly in silent meditation. One day, a devotee who had camped there for nearly a month and who had come with many questions to ask, finally got so frustrated that he broke all the local rules of etiquette and burst out crying, "Oh sage, I am waiting here for nearly a month with many questions to ask, questions of vital importance to me, and you are not even bothering to speak to me." Ramana then slowly opened his eyes, gently smiled and replied, "Son, I have already answered all your questions." The devotee was shocked and he muttered, "How can that be? This is the first time you have actually spoken to me. Thus far you have remained silent." Ramana continued smiling and said, "Silence, that is my answer to all your questions. Silence your mind and all your problems would be solved." That silence that Ramana talks about has been brought to our notice by Swami also with the words, "It is only in silence that the voice of God can be heard." What is this silence that Ramana and Swami are talking about? Not the silence that results when we shut off our vocal cords, but the silence of the mind which results from the quelling of thoughts. When the ceaseless chatter of the mind comes to a halt, the gentle whisper from the heart within can be heard. It is to remind us of this that Bhagavan sometimes gives a diamond ring to a few devotees, adding that the diamond is meant to remind them of the command, "Die mind." Now when Swami says "die mind," he really means let your lower mind die. It is in the lower mind that the six famous enemies of man hide, constantly trying to lead humans away from the path that leads one back to God. Okay, let's suppose that the useless chatter in the lower mind is shut off. What happens then? Very simple. The voice of God or our conscience can speak to us via the pipeline called Buddhi. If Buddhi had operated, it would have told Arjuna, "Oh Arjuna, you are falling into a trap set by the lower mind. You are analyzing this war entirely on a worldly basis. No, you must not do that. Remember, before you take any action, especially one that might involve questions of ethics and morality, ask yourself a few basic questions like, is this good or is it bad? Is it right or is it wrong? Is it selfish or is it unselfish?" Good, right and selflessness are all based on your permanent aspect, namely the Atma. The other choices are all based on the lower aspect, namely your transient body. Always choose that course of action that is based on the permanent and not the transient. That should always be your duty. That is your dharma or mama dharma. That is what Buddhi would have told Arjuna if his Buddhi had been functioning. It was not functioning, that is why he went to Krishna who fixed it. To be technically correct, the Gita uses the word swadharma, but that is the same as what Swami refers to as mama dharma. The golden rule thus says, when in doubt, always swear by mama dharma, always, never waver. Is it any wonder that Swami repeatedly tells us, always follow your master, your conscience is your real master? Very true, because what we casually refer to as conscience is really the voice of God resident within us. There on the battlefield, Krishna gave a one-time advice to Arjuna. But that same God is also with us. He is also within us. In fact, He is within us all the time, 24/7. Swami travels with us wherever we go, to London or Timbuktu or whatever. Swami within never sleeps. Only we hardly allow the Swami within to speak to us. If only we allow the Swami within to do that, just imagine how different the world would be. Well, this leaves me with the famous Brahmarpana Slokam, 4:14 that we are all supposed to chant before every meal. Basically, it is a reaffirmation of the fact that God is not only everywhere all the time, but in fact, God is everything. There's nothing else other than God. This is a profound truth, and I can hardly do justice to that in whatever time is left in this talk, since it is time to end. I hope to make amends some other time. So, winding up in summary in this talk, I basically said the following. 1. Karma Yoga expounded in the Gita is essentially a practical manual for following Mama Dharma. 2. Action must be meaningful in a spiritual sense, otherwise it amounts to inaction in the context of Mama Dharma. 3. We do not have to acquire spiritual knowledge. It's already latent in us. However, it is hidden by a thick layer of spiritual ignorance. When that ignorance is scrubbed away, following Mama Dharma becomes easy. 4. Actions are a must and they are inevitably diverse. But they all become pointless unless they form a part of the fabric of Mama Dharma. A careful study of the lives of various saints would give us plenty of clues about how to convert inaction into spiritually meaningful action. 5. And in this context, keeping buddhi sharp is a must. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. And Jai Sai Ram.
You have been listening to a talk by Professor Venkatraman in the Musing series on the essence of the Gita. The next talk in this series would be broadcast the week after next at the same time. We hope you enjoyed this program. Please do write to us with your comments. You may reach us at listener@radiosai.org. This program came to you from the studios of Radio Sai, which broadcasts 24 hours a day the loving message of Bhagavan Sri Satya Sai Baba.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
ಸರ್ವಗುಣ ಗಾಯಕ ಕೃಪಾವಂತ ಪ್ರಭು ಗುಣ ಗ್ರಾಹಕ ಶ್ರೀ ಗಣರಾಯ ಆದಿ ವಂದು ತುಜ ಮೋರಯ ಗಜಾನನ ಶ್ರೀ ಗಣರಾಯ.